Powelltown. No sheriff in here. No laws either. Again, Hattie's voice.
You can't rely on anybody else, Carol. Not when you're inside a place nobody else can go. You must find peace in there, or rage. Either way, your own. And then maybe you can act on it.
Her husband was trying to kill her, and an old dismissive lover was riding to check up on her too late. If ever she could be excused for lack of peace, this was that time. Moxie. She'd heard more than just Dwight's voice, too. The ceiling had been creaking for many minutes, though time was difficult to track in the coma. How many people were upstairs? And did anybody, any one of them, wonder as to where she was?
This is your wake.
John Bowie's voice. The truth. This resonated. Huge. A volcanic eruption of more shadows. Was anybody up there who might help her? Anybody prone to suspicion?
Sheriff Opal!
Carol called, but her lips did not part. Possibly Harrow's beloved sheriff was standing a floor above her, kindly paying his respects for a woman who was not dead. The anger Carol felt at this thought was strong enough to momentarily dull the nerves. Hattie would have been proud. Hattie, she thought, her thoughts like muffled voices.
John, help me. Tell me how to move. Tell me how to stop falling. Give me 100 more theories to go with the 100 you already gave me. Maybe one will work. One must work.
Oh, how Carol wanted to crawl out of Howelltown. How she wanted to climb the steps to the kitchen, take the hall to the parlor, present herself, as the darkness of the coma clung to her in pieces like mud to the body of the unearthed dead.
Not dead,
she would say, just as James had written to Dwight. Not dead. And the expressions of grief would fall from the faces of the grievers, and Sheriff Opal would quietly take Dwight's wrist in his hand. Of the many experiments Hattie conducted on an adolescent Carol was one she called the object light. When Carol went under, Hattie would light a solitary candle and stand in one corner of the room for 5 minutes, then stand in another. Then she'd bring it a step closer. 5 minutes spent at each spot in the room, as Carol lay dead-like on the floor. When Carol woke, Hattie would ask her if she'd seen it, the light, at any point in the fall. If she had, Hattie theorized, if there was a certain angle, perhaps a spot, that showed in the darkness, they could build upon that knowledge. But there was no light in Howelltown. Never. John Bowie had ideas, too.
Since Howelltown is an abstract place, have you considered simply imagining a door?
This way of thinking best defined the difference between Hattie's hard-nosed, we can build you stairs in there, and John's spiritual kinesis. And while both were trying to help, always, always, neither worked any better than the other. Yet Carol tried. She tried to remember a time when she and James Moxie were very young, teenagers off the trail, when it felt as if, together, they could keep the comas at bay. James, she believed, lived in Mackatoon these days. And as she fell deeper into the darkness, as the winds whispered of silence and death so close to her ears, Carol understood that whether or not he was coming, Mackatoon was a 2-day ride. How soon would Dwight get her into the earth?
Sheriff Opal!
But her lips did not part. As she felt rage rush through her still body, as she fought against ascribing any hope to a man who once deserted her, her lips did not part. And the labored breathing, the hoarse rhythm that acted as a clock in Howelltown, inhaled. Exhaled. Again. And between these thunderous respirations, the bitter music by which she worked, Carol tried. Tried to move. Moxie on the Trail. 9 years. The words came quickly, and they hurt. It had been 9 years since Moxie quit the trail. 9 years since he'd last left Mackatoon under the morning sun. And in those years, even in the years before those, Carol's condition hadn't entirely left his mind. Her sudden comas, the state she fell into, the death trance, where not even the finest instruments could detect a heartbeat. Oh, the appearance of death, the limp body of the woman he desired, was not something a young James Moxie could handle. It was enough to send him running, directionless, toward the trail. And it was on the trail, this trail, that he became legend. A myth he foolishly believed had ended 9 years ago, but that he had taken up again this morning. Do you have another magic trick in you? Thoughts were always shinier, wider, more difficult to corral on the trail. 15 years. Because that's how long it was since Moxie had been to Harrow's. The well-to-do town's name brought with it many memories, most of which were peaceful. Harrow's was where he and his longtime riding partner Jefferson slept under the stars, out there in the wheat fields at the town's southern border. The pair had fun in those sleepy willow trees, dancing with women from town, drowning in wild youth, drunk and free. Yet not entirely free. Never free of the guilt for having left a lover because she was sick. At the word lover, Moxie felt a familiar tugging on his heart. Was it possible he had never fallen out of love with Carol? Could a man sustain such a feeling 20 years since seeing her? Harrow's was also the name of the place where Carol got married, to a man named Dwight Evers, and long ago this news tore holes in Moxie's soul. For a long time, Moxie believed he was past all this, had grown bigger than these memories. But now that they had returned, it was clear they'd always been close. He spit in the dirt, barely missing his boot and the body of the mare. Of course, Harrow's was the farthest town on the trail. All things Carol, for him, were as trying, as cumbersome, as out of reach. 20 years. Had it really been over 2 decades since last he saw her? And could she, as she was now, replace the vision he'd held for all those years? Looking into the dark shadows of the trail, Moxie didn't believe she could. Carol would always come cleaner than he, younger than he, smarter than he, and better. Carol, whether or not she had grown bitter, could never shake the perfect temperament his memory afforded her. What was she like now? Free? Happy? Anxious? These were not romantic notions, but rather the refined and whittled forms of once true, literal images, forms reshaped from years of the guilt squeeze, the scalpel of regret, as it came again and again from a distance Moxie could never quite locate. Every line in Carol's face, every fold in a skirt she once wore, even the dust at the tip of her boots, any and all of it were the rendering of this guilt, this good promise destroyed by him 2 decades past, before his name was known on the trail, before he assumed the life of the outlaw for having broken his own inner codes, the laws within, without the knowledge, of course, of how to fix them. Moxie was only half a mile outside of Mackatoon, and already the sunless borders were shifting in the spectral darkness of the trail. At all points wide enough to allow a carriage passage, and at many points, too, the solid earth of the trail reached sudden walls of heavy vegetation, the towers of plant life, the very greens that brought so much claustrophobia to those who rode. Today, for all the memories these walls stirred and for all the movement within the shadows, the trail was certainly quiet. Moxie wondered if it had always been so, the early hours, the sun not yet high enough to expose all that traveled, crawled, or pulled itself along the packed earth and dry mud, in those rare places where the sun bore down in full. Perhaps this time, this journey, he was finally seeing it for what it was. He thought of all the men who once wanted to ride with him, long ago, having heard of his trick at Aberystown. He felt the false glory of that now. The mare was steady, breathing hard, but breathing well. Moxie looked ahead, where the black borders seemed to meet, to close up, to swallow. It was on this stretch that Moxie and Jefferson raced drunk on horseback, each fueled by individual bad moods, trying to beat them, trying to feel good again.
"Reborn!"
Jefferson kept calling.
"Reborn!"
Moxie recalled closing his eyes, the horse then leading him blind as dirt pelted the skin of his face. The hooves were thunder that day, but an actual storm enveloped the trail by night, and he and Jefferson were small, dry islands beneath an oak under the inevitable black wave of rain.
"Reborn!"
The false freedom of the trail, the impossibility of living a life with no rules. It hurt, these memories, seeing it all, himself, so clearly now. Who had he fooled? Certainly not Carol. The guilt was, and always had been, tremendous. Something big moved in the brush to Moxie's right, and the old outlaw did not make a sudden move. He looked slowly from under the tan brim of his hat. It had been a long time since Moxie had to distinguish between animal and man, but he would never unlearn the lesson of the trail. A man, he thought. An outlaw. A deer materialized in the grain shadows. Had he no feel for this place anymore? This stretch of trail was the very length he came south down, 9 years ago, heading for Mackatoon, done with the trail at last. Mackatoon was hardly more than a name to him then, a peaceful place, far enough from the towns that called him legend. He was 30 years old then, had years then, years he would tend to his garden, his library of books, and the better side of 3 aging horses in an uneasy but deserved solitude. And yet, was any of it deserved? Carol, he suddenly thought, and the town of Harrow's felt very far away. The few words delivered in Ferradero's telegram were enough to suggest volumes of memory in great detail, a floating diary of heart-pounding episodes. His mind was with Carol, but Carol was only the start, the spark that flamed the years to follow. His years alone, breathing the air of the trail he no longer wanted to be famous on. It was enough to puncture his spirit, enough to drive Moxie a little mad, with memory, with morality, with whether or not the years had been wasted. He'd made a name here, the letters of that name constituting as much a myth as any to have raised hell's heaven through these woods, these waters, this dirt. It was enough to confuse him, too, to mock him, to arouse in him warring conclusions. The trail did this to troubled men. Tangled them like unseen strings on a magician's stage. 2 days of riding could kill him. Movement from the brush to his left. Moxie turned slow. Moxie had heard more than his share of trail myths. Yarns rolled down steep hillsides, unraveling until they shapeshifted from fiction to fact. Chilling tales that lent the long, winding, and often isolated path a shade of something darker. A color deeper than midnight blue, more blinding than black. Some rumors were worse, Moxie thought, than robbery, rape, and murder. These stories dressed the trail in a cloak, gave it claws. These stories gave the trail its horror. For who that rode so far from reason could deny the possibility of hysteria? Movement again. Moxie eyed it. There was a man in the brush, standing, facing the trail. Moxie slowed the horse. He placed his right hand on his right holster. It wasn't uncommon for strangers to draw guns without a warning on the trail. Moxie had done it himself many times. Nobody walked the trail alone with good intentions, and a man half hidden by the branches of a hackleberry tree certainly was hiding. Drawing first was wise, and the dance that followed was often an ugly one. "Draw," Jefferson used to say, "before you even know they're there." But Moxie did not draw, and as he passed it, the shape in the shadows became only the bulging of a tree's trunk, as if the tree itself were trying to fool him. Moxie nudged the mare along. The fabled outlaw, famous for his duel in Aberystown, continued. Not a man, Moxie thought, and yet, behind him now, the shape laughed, a sound Moxie could not hear. As the mare entered deeper shadows still, the shape emerged from the tree trunk and followed. The shadows came with it, as if flowing from the figure, a cloak, an afterimage, a blackened second being. The figure had features, details buried in the body of its silhouette. But these were no more than gradations of black, lips only a bat could see, unseen wrinkles in a face that rippled without wind. It laughed again. A subtle ripple in the leaves of the birch, a wave in the bark, too. The borders of the trail shook with it. Moxie noticed, and so did the mare. "You saw me," the shape whispered. "Perhaps you recognized me, too. We once cheered whiskey in Portsoth. How long till you admit you know me?" "Not long." Moxie, sensing a whisper on the wind, pulled gently on the reins, cocked his head to one side. "You carry me all the way to Harrow's," Moxie told the mare, "and I'll let you sleep in the house." There existed maps that declared the boundaries of these woods, maps in the souvenir shops, the welcome posts, on the very wall behind which Sheriff Opal of Harrow sat back in his chair and thought nothing of James Moxie or Carol Evers at all. Not yet. Yellowed paper maps like a monocle on the black beady eye of a bird, a photo, a moment, a view. But there was no accounting for the scope of experiencing the trail firsthand. The trail, it seemed, was bigger in person than it was on paper. The legends were off, the space immeasurable. And within that space, trickery. More laughter now, a sliver of it heard, a piece, the unfolding of a triangular corner of a memory. Moxie rode steady, quiet, listening. His red shirt a nosebleed on the dark lips of the trail. A definitive path of sunlight appeared as the trees overhead parted at last. No longer early morning, day was nearly at hand. Moxie recalled a night at a tavern in Portsouth 20 years past, seated at a wet wood bar, a stranger suddenly beside him.
"It's love,"
Moxie drunkenly declared that night, speaking to the stranger with no introduction.
"But it's more, too much more."
The stranger was somehow featureless. Moxie attributed this to the whiskey.
"Leave her, then."
A voice sharp as the barber's blade, the meaning even sharper. Moxie, then, in love for the first time, turned to the man he couldn't place, could not entirely define.
"Leave her? What do you mean by that?"
"I mean a great deal," the stranger said. "More than we have time to discuss."
"Please, tell me what you mean."
Because Moxie needed to know. Moxie needed to make a decision. Then the stranger said something that Moxie would never forget, no matter how many fresh memories were made.
"Your mind is already made up."
He had to say something in return, had to refute this. But even then, Moxie knew it was true.
"You know the workings of my mind?"
Here the stranger laughed. Things rippled then in the bar not unlike the way they would ripple 20 years later on the trail.
"Carol," the stranger said. "Do you hear her name, Carol? I've said it again. And how does it make you feel? What's not the feeling that settles, but the feeling that comes first?"
Moxie, ambushed by this direct talk, stared blankly into the bottles behind the bar. The stranger went on.
"You can't care for her, Moxie. No man can. This woman asks too much. She is too much."
The words felt heavy, ugly, mean.
"It's not her fault."
"No, it never is."
"It's not her—"
"In your more lucid moments, Moxie, fault means nothing to you. She exists, James Moxie, and she exists for you in this way. This terribly demanding, clumsy way."
Moxie looked up suddenly to the barkeep.
"Get another," the stranger said. "Get two."
Moxie, drunk, scared, young, ordered two more. The drinks came quick, and he slowly slid one toward the stranger. Moxie raised his glass and saw a wrinkled hand raise the other.
"Now," the stranger said, "we cheer."
Beyond them, outside them, loud voices cried, women cackled, glasses came down upon wood. Moxie felt his glass touch the stranger's, and in that moment, in the briefest illumination, a break in the shadows and smoke showed him the man's face. Moxie gasped.
"Who are you?"
Moxie, not yet legend, was scared. The stranger laughed. It seemed to come from every booth, every corner of the tavern.
"Drink. Drink, and I'll show you."
Moxie closed his eyes. The whiskey went down harsh. His chest burned. When he opened his eyes, the stranger was closer.
"I'm the guilty thought you have of leaving the one you love. I'm the twisting in your heart. I'm the sour end of things, the brittle finish, when all hope of recovery has been swallowed by the snouts of the pigs."
The tavern door opened to allow another patron in, and Moxie saw rain falling from the darkened sky. He slurred as he spoke.
"I don't understand."
A glass broke in a corner booth, and Moxie looked, and when he looked back, he saw the stranger was closer yet.
I am present when things fall apart. The stranger's lips weren't moving. Moxie tried to tell himself it was the whiskey. Despite the proximity, he couldn't get a read on the man's face, as if the man had many faces at once. I am the stranger at the funeral, the one all mourners say belongs to someone else. He held Moxie's blurred gaze. His own was still as the face in a dark oil portrait. His lips did not move. I am rot, James Moxie. I am the moment after you've decided to leave the one you love. I'm a step beyond guilt, after the feeling has turned black, once the mold sets in. Laughter, all throughout the tavern. Moxie felt a gust of cold air as another man stumbled through the door, arm over the shoulders of a thin woman. Moxie, breathing hard, did not want to look back at the face of the stranger. Were it not for death, I would hardly exist. The stranger laughed again. Then laughter erupted forth from every booth, every shadow. Even the barkeep broke free with it. And still the stranger's face remained expressionless. An oil portrait, yes, an uneasy rendering, the sort of painting children stepped quickly past in the second-story halls of their homes. A gray cloud appeared behind the stranger as smoke rose from the open laughing mouths of the other patrons. Moxie suddenly felt very young, too young. How old was this stranger? It was true that Moxie had come to Portsuit to get far from Carol, from her condition. It had become too much, the regularity with which she collapsed, falling into her death-trance slumber, no pulse, no beat, no breath. And here this stranger knew the workings of his heart. He called himself Rot. In Moxie's blurriness, he wondered if his love was indeed rotting. This man, this thing, this...
You're a monster, he said.
Hearing it, he believed it.
James Moxie, the stranger said, his mouth moving at last. What a mean thing to say.
Now, riding the trail for the first time in 9 years, Moxie did not attribute these memories to the shape he'd seen against the tree in the shadows. No connection was made there at all. Yet Moxie knew well the shudders. The guilt he felt for his decision in Portsuth was a bigger picture than the shadowed portrait he vaguely remembered and could not describe. The face that seemed not to talk when it talked. The mouth that seemed not to laugh when it did.
What was it we cheered?
He thought, glancing up now at the wider breadth of sunlight descending. But he wasn't sure they had cheered anything at all.
James Moxie, the stranger had said. What a mean thing to say.
Yet Moxie remembered the words that followed the hazy toast.
I'm no more a monster than a fox is, let loose in the chicken pen, its snout red with foul blood, its feet wet with eggshells and the smashed bodies of baby chicks yet to see the moon. I'm no more a monster than the man who finds the fox and holds him by his neck to the tree stump where he wields his axe and severs the snout that robbed him. I'm no more a monster than the hiccup in the same man's chest as he bends to lift a box from the cellar stairs, a box to carry the dead chickens. And I'm no more a monster than the water pooled at the bottom of the same cellar stairs down which the man falls, his final face wet and distorted with hate, with pain, and with surprise. In truth, I'm much more like the wife who finds him there and cleans the tragic mess. You see, there are worse things on the trail than the men and women who steal, punish, and brutalize. And I'm not the only one.
The words came rippling to Moxie now, folds in the memory of a man who hadn't taken this path in close to a decade. Oh, the many meanings of the trail.
Harrows, he said.
In Portsuth, he had decided, finally, to turn his back on Carol. But he was going to her now. Love, he thought, and the word came with strength, but no color. The confusion in his heart was manifold. The guilt was direct. Moxie and the mare continued. The shape kept pace. And soon the figure slipped into Moxie's own shadow, vanishing, as the sun broke through again, rose even higher. As the day commenced and the light played tricks with the trail. Lafayette advises Dwight.
Dwight stood in the parlor and peered through the drapes of its biggest window. The last of the grievers were walking toward their carriages, farther, toward their homes. The sky was gray, though it was still very early in the day. It might rain, or possibly. It was an illusion, an afterimage created by the black and gray dress of the men and women who departed, holding hands, arms over shoulders, having experienced the closeness to death that shatters most social walls. Couples climbed the steps to their respective coaches, and Dwight heard their muffled voices instructing their drivers. Home. Go west. Take us to town. Dwight scanned them, men and women of funereal colors, as if Carol were already buried. It brought Dwight great pleasure, the success of the wake. The burial must be no different. As the coaches drove away, dust from the drive rose knee-high in a cloud. And deep within the cloud, Dwight saw Lafayette's form approaching. Every town on the trail harbored someone capable of culling any and all resources from the others. In affluent Harrow's, Lafayette was that woman. Dwight heard the knocking at the door. Lafayette, who wore the same clothing she'd worn the evening before, was professional enough to have knocked quietly. No obvious urgency in a woman who got things done as quickly as possible. And Dwight did not answer straight away, watching as he did the last of the levers, making a small game of the meeting to be, reminding his partner who wielded the power in this house. As the last coach vanished, Dwight responded. Quietly, without speaking, he walked Lafayette into the kitchen, where the sink was stuffed with dishes and the table still loaded with desserts.
"Let me tell you a story, Evers. You want to hear a story?"
Her voice was too loud for Dwight. The early afternoon dew glistened off the toes of Lafayette's boots. Her long chin bobbed as she spoke, in step with her considerable ponytail against her upper back, and the words seemed to cascade down the buttons of her white business blouse. Lafayette was a true 2 inches taller than Dwight, and her size had long assisted her in these matters.
"A young man out of Fryer came to see me once. Said he had spent the whole of his life working toward becoming an oil man. Said he got himself on Mossman's team digging holes and worked himself up to some kind of supervisor. I told the kid I didn't give a pig shit how well he was doing. He was real nervous, asking me if this mister or that mister could hear us, and whispering when whispering wasn't necessary. Told me his family was getting in the way of his being an oil man. Had a wife and 3 daughters. I told him that sounded nice. He told me it would be if they didn't get in the way. I told him whatever family he had was his own decision and his own fault, and he looked over his shoulder and asked me to keep it down. Said he needed to get rid of the family. I told him he should get a divorce. Even cited a lawyer he should see. 'I didn't come to you for legal advice,' he says. I said, 'But yes, you did.' He told me the wife was demanding he be home for this or that, making life real hard for him when he made to leave for the day's work. I told him that's what families do. But he was serious, and he had the money, and I suggested to him the same man I'm suggesting to you right now. He said, 'Fine, that would be fine.' I don't know if he had something on the side, and a pig could shit and I'd care more about that, but he paid me right then and I told him to go to work tomorrow just like he did every day, and by the time he got home, it'd be done. He shuddered like all men shudder after things are determined, and we parted ways. He came to me a week after, shaking, boiling, fumed. I don't like public scenes, Evers, and I took him by his shirt and pulled him into an alley and told him he better get his head together. He told me he came home from work to find his wife charred, her bones in an odd way on the front lawn, the spine and arms and skull set up as though she were crawling up and out of the earth. I told him the man I'd suggested sounded like an artist. He said that wasn't the worst of it. Said he found the bones of his 3 girls sitting on the porch in a circle. Black bones. Said they were set up so they were pointing at the bones of their mother, as though acknowledging her emerging from the ground. Said they were screaming, screaming skulls. I told him any skull can look like it's screaming. He was mad, Evers, red mad. He said he hadn't asked for the children to be involved. I told him he'd asked for the family. He said he meant it different, meant it like his wife was the family. And don't I know that kids can't stop a man from moving up in the oil world? I told him to be more specific next time. He started shaking again, and he told me that around the knee bones of the kids was a small pile of snuff, as if Mama was coming up from the dirt to get her some, and like the kids didn't want her to have it. Told me the animal had to have set it up that way, that while he was at work, a true blue psycho was chuckling on his lawn, setting up his daughter's bones like they were little fiends. I asked him if he had more time now for the oil gig. He said, yes, he did.
You see, Dwight said, that story scares me.
I should hope it does.
I don't want a loose bird on my dollar. Lafayette's wrinkled face stretched into a smile. Her eyes had never looked so deep-set to Dwight.
Whoever you hire, he's going to be a little bit mad,
she said. You told me he was a cripple.
So he is.
Dwight shook his head. Lafayette went on.
The man's good, Evers.
I want someone who can get to him fast.
You'll catch him. You'll get to him before he reaches Harrow's. I can guarantee that.
What's my insurance?
You hire Smoke. He does it.
That's not good enough.
Isn't it? You don't want to hire someone to watch this guy.
Dwight looked as though he might.
Evers?
Lafayette said.
This man doesn't count the same sheep that we do.
It's my dollar. Lafayette's smile fell from her eyes.
You hire someone to watch Smoke, and Smoke might start watching you.
He sounds more than a little mad.
He is, and he's in the area.
Dwight looked out the window quickly. What area?
Mackatoon.
Another job?
Another job.
Then Dwight looked Lafayette in the eye and nodded, and it was sealed. Lafayette studied him.
I'm curious, she said. What did James Moxie do to you?
Dwight looked surprised, as if Lafayette was suggesting Moxie could or would do something to him. Nothing.
But you want him killed.
He didn't want to tell Lafayette that Moxie knew Carol's secret. A revelation like that would send cracks through the foundation of their plan.
What else did you overlook, Evers? Maybe I should get out now, Evers. Maybe you brought me in on a sour deal.
Nothing yet, Dwight said.
And this has nothing to do with your wife?
No, Dwight said. Nothing at all. Lafayette laughed. It was the sound of one who doesn't want to know where someone else buries their dirt. She started for the door.
And you don't want a loose bird.
But Dwight wouldn't let her have the last word. He cried out to her as she exited his home, yelling as the front door closed.
This is my idea. This is what I want to do. Don't forget, Lafayette. I brought you in on this deal. I'm making the big decisions here.
But Lafayette, having her hands in every conceivable channel of communication, her ears to every telegram office on the trail, had already known about Ferradero's telegram to James Moxie. For this, Lafayette had hired Smoke on her own. Smoke to follow Moxie. The loose bird in the legend. Let Dwight Evers think he was making big decisions. Let him believe he was emerging, born again, from the shadow of his wife. And let him suffer too, under the weight of that new sun. Fresh Oil. It once was he rode into town and people blanched. Men avoided his eyes, and women turned their backs, hoping not to be seen. It once was the domesticated dogs of the trail towns barked at him from afar. It once was he was whole. He was awesome. He was dread. And while he was certainly still noticed, Smoke spotted the benign curiosity in the eyes of the Mackatooners now. Things hadn't been like they used to be in a long time. Old men nudged each other on front porches, and kids stopped to look up at the rider, whose legs hung limply by the horse's side. He was a rare sight indeed, the gangly, limp-legged, hatless man arriving on Blandon Street.
Even the traditionally disinterested had to watch him, and anybody who saw him held his image a breath or two longer than they would an ordinary stranger. His thinning hair added years to him that he had not earned. His yellow shirt, rolled to the elbows, gifted him levity that he did not deserve. And the fact that he carried no gun squelched the uneasiness his image inspired. He was not feared. Not yet. Smoke halted the horse at the post office, where a series of hitching posts stood crooked in the dirt. Only one was unused, and Smoke knew it was going to be difficult getting off the gelding without much room to maneuver. He gripped his right thigh and lifted the whole of his leg up and over the horse's head. The scant oil sloshed within. He'd used most of it on this Macatoon job and the broken carriage that followed. A small lady, watching, felt pity for him and crossed the street, her eyes sympathetic behind thick glasses. It didn't used to be like this.
"Do you need some help?"
she said, looking up at him. Others on the street grew silent, sensing what the woman had not. While the stranger was certainly crippled, it didn't mean he wasn't dangerous. The trail delivered tricks all the time. Smoke faced the lady, seated as he was, both legs on the same side of the horse.
"That I do," he said, his voice a sing-song. But some in earshot knew better than to sing along. "Nowhere to get good oil around here."
The lady smiled, seeing the man didn't catch her meaning.
"Yes, in fact..."
She turned and pointed up the planked porches of the Blandon Street shops beneath their wood awnings.
"If you just,
"Walk?" Smoke asked, helping her sound out the word.
"Why, yes, if you just walk on up the boardwalk there, beyond the blacksmith, you'll find Kirk's General. He sells oil out the back."
"Is it the good stuff?"
Smoke asked, pointing at the lady and raising his eyebrows high.
"It better be the good stuff, or it just won't do."
The lady considered.
"Yes," she said. "I'm not sure, of course, of what you're used to, but I think it works fine. Many people get their oil at Kirk's."
"Kirk's?"
"Yes."
Smoke braced himself as he pushed off the horse's back and slid to the ground. He landed hard. The oil sloshed, and the tin cut through the old rags and into the flesh of his stubs. He suppressed a howl and forced a smile instead.
"Oh, my,"
the lady said.
"Are you sure I can't help you? I can maybe run and get some for you. And there's a very good doctor in town as well."
Smoke held her eyes as he hitched the horse and removed a small hip satchel of rags.
"What would I need with a doctor, ma'am?"
And his voice was not sing-song anymore. His voice was the pain of stolen legs. The lady blushed, understanding at last that she had broached an offensive topic.
"I didn't mean anything by it, young man. I just saw you were struggling some."
"How so, struggling?"
The lady smiled nervously. She looked to Blandon Street for someone who might explain it better than she.
"I can't say exactly. I..."
"Show me."
But others on the street backed away. A man gripped a pistol in its holster. The lady stammered.
"Tell me."
Smoke limped toward her.
"Was I crying?"
"Well, no, of course not."
"Was I hanging from my horse like I might fall?"
"Pardon?"
Smoke limped closer yet, and the lady arched back.
"Let me know,"
Smoke said.
"Please, I need to know. Was I slobbering? Was I slobbering all over myself?"
The lady turned her face from him, trying to locate a smile, but not finding it.
"Let me know,"
he whispered now, his lips touching her ear.
"Is it that obvious I've got a problem with my legs?"
The lady stammered. Someone cocked a gun. Smoke's face burst into a smile. He thrust his hands toward the sky, and the lady screamed.
"Of course there's a problem with my legs, ma'am!"
He laughed, and the lady, staring at his outstretched fingers, laughed nervously with him. Smoke planted a palm flat on her shoulder. He eyed the man who had cocked the gun.
"Shudders,"
he said, speaking to the lady.
"Thanks an awful lot for the oil tip. I'll go check it out for myself. Walk there, even."
The lady breathed relief. Fear, Smoke thought, like it used to be.
Kirk's,
she repeated, still shaking. But if it's not the good stuff, Smoke said, his lips curling down again, I'll have no choice but to find you, ask you what made you think it was. The lady stammered, but Smoke was already limping past her. Blandon Street was silent as he stepped awkwardly up onto the boardwalk and struggled toward the general store. He stuck his tongue out at a man standing just inside a tavern. He passed the open door of the blacksmith and chuckled at the sight of the fat man forging a pistol. A gentleman exited Kirk's General and saw Smoke and held the door for him. Smoke stared at him blankly, and the man, confused, let it close and passed him. Smoke opened the door himself and limped inside.
I hear you've got the good stuff, he bellowed. Oil!
I'll be with you in just a moment. It was an old man, his face bunched, reviewing a ledger through glasses on the end of his nose. Behind him was a towering oak shelf of glass jars. The counter displayed boxes of candy for children. The dark wood floors and walls made something of a shadowed box out of the space, and Smoke thought of the road magician he'd seen who made a donkey disappear. He stepped to the counter and eyed the ledger with the shopkeeper. The old man, seeing he hadn't gotten through to the customer, set the ledger down.
Yes, and how can I help you, sir?
Smoke spoke slowly, deliberately. The oil, of course, was very important to him.
A real nice lady told me you got the good stuff here. The best oil in town.
I've got oil.
Is it the good stuff?
Well, I'm not sure I know the difference.
Smoke frowned.
Does it burn easy, man?
The proprietor eyeballed Smoke long before answering.
As well as oil burns, I gather.
Smoke nodded.
Sounds like the good stuff. Where do you keep it?
The man wiped his hands on his blue apron and walked Smoke the length of the store to a back door made of pine.
Barrels are in there. Check it out for yourself. Might not be the oil you're looking for.
You need the money now?
Smoke asked.
Nope. Bring out whatever you need and I'll count it from there. Too many folk come in saying they need a thimble and come up with a mug. Fuddles up my paperwork, it does.
Then the man left him. Smoke slipped behind the wood door and saw six big barrels in the dim light. From where he stood, it looked like standard fare, maybe something a bit better, and he knew it would do. He grabbed a handful of rags from a shelf, limped across the dark room to a stool, and sat down, quickly rolling up his pant legs, then unfastening the belts holding the tin shins to his legs. It always felt good to do this. Big relief. Like removing a hat on a hot summer day. He removed both shins, sensing the trigger strings as they tickled his thighs on the way down his pants. Yes, it always felt good to take the legs off. He turned them over, letting the old stuff spill out on Kirk's dirty floor. His naked thighs were pocked with sores, spots where the flesh was discolored, unhealthy, and maybe would never get good again. He brought one of the shins to his lap and quietly removed the boot. The toe was packed with cloth, and Smoke pulled it out, then jammed a fresh one from his satchel back in. Things were already feeling cleaner. He did the same with the other boot, and then set to funneling the oil into the tin cylinders, holding the heels closed with his thumbs, blocking any spillage. Out of the barrels, the oil looked smoother than he'd guessed it would. When both shins were full, Smoke set one down, picked up a boot, and replugged it with the tin stump at its end. He held the string now with his thumb to make sure he didn't have to fish it out of the boot later. He centered the shin, then set it all on the floor to make double sure. Then he removed the dirty cloth lining the top of the shin and replaced it with a rag from the shelf. He tore it in half, not wanting the whole thing. It was difficult walking with too much padding under the stub. Once the shin was ready, he set to doing the same for the other. The old man never came back, and Smoke guessed he was lost in his ledger. Maybe he was having a good day. Smoke sure was. James Moxie, he thought. It was just another job, always. But he couldn't deny the luster, the way the outlaw's name was lit up on fire in his mind. James Moxie was a legend of the trail, In fact, he'd become so just about the time Smoke lost his legs. Felt damn close to an eclipse, the way Moxie suddenly rose up and blocked Smoke's own legend on the way.
Moxie, 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 my, a drop of oil in your eye.
After wrapping his job here in Mackatoon, Smoke found a paper jutting out from under his saddle. Sometimes the trail watchers operated this way. Hidden notes, secret papers. It was just a job, of course, but James Moxie could be trickier than most. He was certainly tricky at Aberystown. Smoke was no stranger to magic. He'd watched many shows, clamoring with the crowds as the traveling magicians came through with their caravans. He'd watched enough sleight of hand to consider his own trick, false shins, to be something of an illusion, too. The reappearing legs, and yet there was an edge to what Moxie did in Aberystown. Smoke knew that some men were levitating women these days. Some made elephants disappear. But what exactly had Moxie done to win that duel, without so much as removing his gun?
Moxie, 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 myth, fibs and fiction, pomp and piss.
The two shins were set upright on the ground, and he slid his knees directly above them. He threaded the strings up his pant legs as far as they would reach, barely poking out the holes he'd cut long ago in his pockets. Then, using his arms, he lowered himself from the stool. He shifted the stubs of his knees against the rags, covering the tin, until he had it right. Then finally, he began the laborious task of strapping the belts to the existing sore spots on his thighs. Finished, he rolled his pant legs back down. He looked at his legs in the dim light. Presto. Jamming his hands in his pockets, he thumbed the string loops and tugged, allowing the heels of his boots to open, spreading a small amount of Kirk's own fresh oil on the floor. He let go of the strings. He could sing all he wanted about James Moxie, but Smoke knew there was something to that Aberystown story. Maybe it was the fact he hadn't heard a theory that explained it, or maybe Smoke's interest rose in relief from the ashes of his own fallen name. Sweating, Smoke leaned side to side, testing his balance. It'd be a bad thing to walk back into the store, take a fall, and spill all this fresh oil in front of the proprietor himself. It had happened before. He held his arms out, leaned forward, leaned back. Things felt good. Things felt great. He brought one of the dirty rags to his nose and huffed the remaining fumes.
James Moxie, he thought again, and this time a wave of infallible confidence washed over him. I'm a man of magic, too.
Reloaded, Smoke limped through the wood door and back into the shop.
How much you get?
The old man asked as Smoke appeared. Smoke shook his head.
It wasn't the good stuff.
The man eyeballed him, looked him over from head to boot tip.
Eh? Sure we're back there long enough.
That's how I do it, Smoke said, stopping before the counter. I take my oil very seriously. Your stuff is good, just not the good stuff.
Kirk stared as the strange, hatless man limped out of his store empty-handed. Back on the planked walk, Smoke entered a tavern. Inside, the locals watched him walk.
Got any matches here?
Sure we do. You want to get a beer with them, though.
Can't just get a box?
Gotta get a beer with it.
Let me think about that.
The bartender addressed someone else, and Smoke turned and limped back to the door. Two men talking at a table paused to watch him pass. Maybe they'd heard of him. A lot of people had. It wasn't until Smoke was upon his horse again and riding, heading north, that the bartender noted the missing matches from their container. By then, Smoke was gone, his voice a sing-song rhyme.
Moxie, 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 move, I'm coming, coming after you.
Clyde and the Gravediggers. While Farrah was returning home from mailing her telegram to James Moxie, a thing she could hardly believe she did, and a thing she wasn't sure why she did, except for a feeling that he should know, her husband Clyde was battling a hangover the enthusiastic way. He was already drinking at the Lamb's Wool. But despite the liquor, and what he hoped it might do for himself, all he could think of was the story Farrah had told him late last night.
finding her lady's body in the cellar of the Evers' home. It was unsettling, of course, though Clyde guessed most of that was because of the manner in which it was told. He'd never known someone to cry as much as his wife had the night before. Clyde, lifting a glass from the wood bar, sipped.
"It's a bit early, even for you, Clyde," the bartender Bill said.
Clyde looked over his shoulder to the otherwise empty tavern, as if expecting backup and finding none.
"I had something of a long night, long morning, too."
As Clyde set his glass back upon the bar, the saloon doors swung in, and Hank James and Lucas Morgan entered. Clyde knew they were gravediggers at the Manders' funeral home, and he'd spoken with both more than once. Drunk nights, as music played, brief conversations about death in dim lighting. Today, though, their figures reminded him only of Farrah, for Farrah's lady died, and Farrah's lady would be buried, no doubt, in a grave dug by these men.
"Hello, Bill,"
Lucas said, sitting a stool away from Clyde. He turned and tipped his hat to Clyde, and Clyde nodded in return. Hank followed his fellow digger. The pair did not order, but Bill provided them with glasses of whiskey anyway.
"You've had a workload, I'd say," Bill said, folding his arms. "Enough graves for a season, I'd say."
Hank nodded.
"That we have, the illness. More digging these past 2 weeks than my shoulders care to tell you."
"Could have dug a hole to Albertsport,"
Lucas said, and the three men smiled. Soon their conversation became meaningless sounds and syllables for Clyde, and his thoughts returned once again to Farrah and her story. The events she described came coupled with a bad, low feeling in his chest and belly, but he couldn't pinpoint exactly why. Was there anything exactly wrong with a man keeping his wife in the cellar after finding her dead? Would Farrah have preferred the bedroom?
"She was glowing, Clyde. She shone."
Farrah kept saying that. All night she kept saying that.
"Bill,"
he called. Bill refilled his glass.
"This is your third already, Clyde," Bill said, meaning no harm by it.
Hank and Lucas turned to look at Clyde, and Lucas said,
"By goodness, there's a real drinker there. Three already, and we haven't even made it to work yet."
They raised their glasses, and Clyde did too, and the three cheered. Hank called what it was they cheered to the end of the illness, and as their glasses touched, Clyde thought of the empty bottle of whiskey on the counter in the kitchen at home. He thought of Farrah drinking from it, and Farrah using it to punctuate the story that bothered her so. After a sip from the fresh drink, Clyde wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and felt at peace for the first time all day. Sure, Farrah was upset, but not because there was something foul about Carol's being in the cellar. Farrah was grieving and nothing more.
"Have you heard, Bill, that Carol Evers passed?"
Clyde looked up to Lucas after the gravedigger spoke, and he listened as the three men talked about how young she was, and whether or not it was the illness that got her. Bill had heard the news from a man who'd been in even earlier than Clyde. Bill also said he thought the illness had left Harrow's, and Lucas and Hank said they'd hoped the same thing. But 38 years only did seem a little young for so vibrant a woman as Carol Evers. So maybe. Then Clyde told them. He didn't think there was anything wrong in telling them. The gravediggers were talking about her death and how Mr. Evers must feel, and without waiting for a right place to insert what he wanted to say, Clyde just told them.
"He's keeping her in the cellar."
The gravediggers turned to him. Bill stopped drying a glass.
"It's what I heard, yeah. Her body is in the cellar, waiting to be buried, I suppose."
He waited for a response. In that moment, drunk as he was, he understood that he wanted to know what these two men thought of what he'd told them. He wanted to know if two professional gravediggers thought it was as strange as Farrah did.
"Well,"
Lucas said, shrugging,
"I suppose she's got to be somewhere."
Bill refilled their glasses, and Clyde felt relief. Not many men in Harrow's had been as close to death as Lucas and Hank. Farrah, he believed, was grieving. Nothing more. Natural.
"You fellas know my wife, Farrah?"
he asked. They did.
"She works for Mr. and Mrs. Evers,"
Clyde went on, blabbering now.
"She's taken her lady's death very hard. She saw her, she did, last night, in the cellar."
Then Clyde downed most of his drink. He thought of the wake Farrah had missed.
If you guys see her, make her feel better. Say something nice. She's taken her lady's death very hard.
He set the glass on the bar, and Bill refilled it. Clyde sipped, feeling some relief for having verified, really, that there was nothing odd about what Mr. Evers was doing. But he had no way of knowing that his loose lips, wet still with whiskey, had allowed powerful words to escape, words that would travel, most innocently, all the way to Sheriff Opal, who would consider it very odd indeed that someone with as many bedrooms as Dwight Evers would keep his dead bride in a cold, drafty storm room in a cellar. Moxie in the Barbershop. Moxie was stepping toward a saloon when he saw the ghost of Molly. It was a small town, Baker, and he'd hooked the mare's reins to a hitching post by a trough, 20 paces from the boardwalk. People walked the planks of Nero Street in summer dresses and dusty vests, and among them, Moxie saw her looking at him from behind a glass door as it was opened, but she was gone by the time the door swung back to. The name Molly crossed his mind, and it was a dark, strange feeling, because the only Molly he knew who looked anything like that did so some 20 years ago. The look of her wouldn't have bothered him as much had she not been gesturing. Yes, when Moxie saw her, the girl behind the glass was beckoning him, asking him to come to her, just as Molly had in a tavern 2 decades past. A band was playing then, and she was asking him to come meet her friend, Carol. Moxie knew he had Carol on the mind. He was nearly strangled with memories of her on the trail. The mare had done the walking, while Moxie swam with Carol in the mossy lake down the hill from the courthouse, stood in the grassy backyard and tossed bugle nuts up at Carol's window, and waited with her in a crowd of sweaty folk, eager to see a boxing match. Yes, he'd been drunk, sober, asleep, upset, in love, and ashamed on this ride, reliving the entirety of his and Carol's youthful tryst. Mistaking a young girl for Molly was understandable, even likely. But Moxie didn't like the gesture. The gesture was too real. The lithe girl had bent forward, eyes wide, beckoning, waving him this way, this way.
"You've got to meet my friend Carol. Carol, come on."
Moxie stepped onto the boardwalk and passed the tavern, trembling inside, twisted with guilt. Ah, that face, the face of Molly, the girl who connected him to Carol in the first place, as if she'd lit a flame that hadn't flickered in 2 decades plus, but hadn't gone out all the same. Coming to the glass door in which he'd seen the apparition, Moxie found it belonged to a barber shop. She was not on the other side of the glass, not even a girl who looked like her. None that he could see. Mostly, the glass reflected the street behind him. The storefronts across the way, a haberdashery with a painted blue sign, horses carting barrows of feed and produce, the people of Baker on their way. Moxie entered the barber shop. A bell chimed above him.
"You can take a seat if you're expecting a shave."
2 men were seated, bibs across their chests. 2 bald men shaved them, and beyond the quartet, in a chair against the back wall, a body under a white slipcover reclined, its head cocked back, its face draped in towels.
"Sir?"
Moxie turned to the closer barber doing the shaving.
"A younger girl," Moxie said. "About 20. Dark hair, bright green eyes. Was she just in here?"
The barbers shook their heads.
"You lost one?"
the heavier one asked.
"I thought I recognized a face."
The thinner barber pointed at him with his razor.
"But you could use a shave as well, if I may be so bold."
Moxie passed them both, heading to the sink and back. The reclining man covered in towels was still as he approached.
"How about you?" Moxie asked him. "You see a young girl come through here, dark hair, green eyes?"
Something shifted beneath the slip, as if the man's chin had moved on its own, without the rest of his face.
"How young, would you say?"
And the voice was a snake's belly upon wet leaves. Moxie gripped his gun.
"Young enough."
"Young enough, you say? Young enough to live without fear, you'd say?"
Moxie looked to the barbers. They were busy with their shaves. Neither seemed to hear.
"I don't have time to banter,"
Moxie said, trying to remain calm, but the voice, familiar.
Young enough to crawl through the swamps if she lost her favorite bow, you'd say?
Moxie fingered the gun at his hip. What do you know about her?
Young enough to believe life is a gift, you'd say?